And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I want to give everybody a heads up on a couple of Zoom presentations coming this Saturday. That's May 9. And one of them is with the San Diego AAII. This will be a 2 to 3 hour presentation, combination of a presentation that I will make on the ultimate buy and hold strategy, the 10 fund, the 4 fund. I've got some new tables to share with you that are, I think, in some ways are easier to use than the tables that we include in our fine-tuning and distribution tables. Some good work that Daryl Balls has done. But I'll be speaking first, and then Chris Pedersen will speak on the 2 Funds for Life strategy. He's been working on some new research there. And then we'll have a Q&A session, and during the Q&A session, it is our hope that Daryl Balls is going to join us. And since he's done so much of the research behind all the tables, I think we're up over 80 tables now that are new to this year. Daryl has done all that work and there to answer questions if folks have some for him. And then, now that's the morning, and those people are going to be generally older investors. AAII itself, typically when I go to speak to a chapter, the people are in their 60s and 70s. Some younger people, but not many. On the other hand, this is a free session and is available on the internet. So I guess that it's going to be a function of whatever limit they might have on their subscription to Zoom. I'm sure they'll archive it. So for people who can't attend, they'll have a chance to see it if they wish. And then that's the morning. And in the afternoon, Chris and Daryl and I will work this time with Choose FI, a meetup open to the public. It too will be free, and there I'll be talking about the $12 million decisions, and Chris will be talking about the 2 funds for life, and then we'll have a Q&A session, and I'm hoping that Daryl will join us for that one as well. So I hope you're able to come out. We will have links to those in the write-up about this podcast that I'm doing right now. So I hope you're there to throw some questions at us. We enjoy that part of the presentation a lot. I want to talk about something that really didn't come to me until yesterday morning. My son called me and he said, "Dad, a happy anniversary." And so I had to stop and think. It didn't come to me immediately. And it was about that time that he said that today, May 3rd, is the 37th anniversary of the Merriman Wealth Management Company. And it wasn't originally the Merriman Wealth Management Company, but in the beginning, the minimum size investment was $2,000. And so you wouldn't typically have the word wealth attached to that. But later in its career, when minimums went up substantially, maybe it's more appropriate. But even if we're talking about somebody starting with a dollar to invest, as far as I'm concerned, that's part of growing whatever wealth you might be able to accumulate. But in that conversation with my son, we talked about how very little we really knew when we started the company. Well, he wasn't in the company originally, but it was only a few years before he did get involved and eventually ended up running the company. But it's true. I mean, I estimate, I know 1,000 times more today about investing than when I started the company on May 3rd, 1983. And I would guess that would be probably true of a whole lot of people that were beginning their career as an investment advisor. And I had had earlier in my life, because I was 40 by that time, but I had been a stockbroker for somewhere between 2 and 3 years back in the late 60s. So I had had a fair amount of exposure, and yet what I know today, what Jeff knows today, what every financial planner, and I am not a certified financial planner, neither was my son a CFP, but I think the Merriman Company has, 15 CFPs on staff now. So today people are much more knowledgeable about the investing process. And I have said many times that investing is much easier today than it was when I first came into the industry back in the mid-60s, and that things are much fairer for the individual investor. Not only is it easier, but it is fairer, and the odds of success are greater. But it is really fascinating how little we knew. Because in 1983, it was kind of in the early days of the financial planning as we know it today. Now, almost every stockbroker, whether they are a financial planner or not, they call themselves a financial planner. They may not be licensed, but it's what we're supposed to be if we're helping, giving people advice with their money. And so as we grow from where we are today, and hopefully we're going to continue to learn more, my focus, and I talked about this in a recent podcast, my focus is really to find those huge decisions. I'm not in the trenches helping people one at a time. I am here at the 30,000-foot level, in a way, trying to make sure that we each do the things that are going to have the greatest impact on our financial future. And to focus on, remember that circle of information within which everything we need to know is included about investing. And there's that little slice of pie that represents what we know, the piece that represents what we know we don't know, the piece that represents what we don't know we don't know, the piece that represents what we know but we're wrong, and finally the piece that we know but we don't do anything about it. And our view is that our job, because we're working to help people either who are do-it-yourselfers or they want to learn so they can make sure the people who are giving them professional advice are doing the right thing, I want to focus on what we know, and then to make sure that we do it. I was working on the beginning of the presentation for this Saturday. I don't remember if I did this with both presentations, but I know that I did it with the presentation for the Choose FI group. And I want to make it very clear as I make those presentations. A lot of those people don't know my work, won't know what to believe or not to believe, but I want to make loud and clear the point that there is no risk in the past, and so I, with the benefit of hindsight, know exactly to tell you what you should have done had you lived as an investor through the same period of time that I know about, or the period of time that I lived through. And that the problem is that we don't know anything about the future. Well, yes, there are some things we know about the future. We know, for example, we might be dedicated to low-cost investments. We might be dedicated to broad diversification. We might be dedicated to dollar-cost averaging into whatever we're investing in on a monthly basis without exception. We know we're trying to minimize our taxes. We know we want to have the right amount of fixed income to bring the volatility of the portfolio down to a level that it's livable for us. I guess we could say we know those things. But what it is we would really like to know is we'd really like to know about what kind of money we're going to make on our investments. And that, I don't have a clue. I have a clue if I look to the past that there are periods where the returns are absolutely phenomenal. I've talked about it ad nauseum from 1975 to 1999. The S&P 500 compounds at over 17, small cap value over 22. And just when we find out about that S&P 500 and we decide that's where we're going to put the fate of our financial future, we invest in it, and for the next 20 years, it compounds at about 5% a year. That is, if we didn't panic and get out at the bottom of the market in 2008 or 2009. So that's the reality. We are going to, with some amount of faith, commit ourselves to investing in something. Now, for some of us, what we choose to invest in will be the latest fad or fashion of investing that people know as having recently been successful. That's what the recency bias is all about, is investing in things that have made money lately. That's why it was so easy to invest in the S&P 500 in 1999. Not only because everybody was doing it, but for the last 5 years, that particular asset class had been compounding at over 25% a year. Oh, that's what we want. Of course, that's what we want. So our goal, Chris and Daryl are just as dedicated to this as I am, is to make sure that we get our arms around what can happen. That's why recently when I talked about bear markets, I said, well, look, back in the 29 through 38 period, there were 9 bear markets, losses of more than 20% from having been through a rise of more than 20%. And the average loss was about 41%, took about 6.5 months on average to get to the end of that, the bottom of that bear market. It was all happening very fast. Can you imagine what that must have been like? In fact, in a way, it even gets worse, because not only during that particular 10-year period did it turn out that we went through these terrible bear markets. Well, in fact, 13 of the worst 20 months of the last since 1926, 13 of those happened during that 10-year period. On the other hand, there's another lesson about that 10-year period. 11 of the very best months since 1926 also happened during that 10-year period. And it's almost seems impossible, but in July 1932 and August 1932, July, August each had increases of over 38%. So you probably went from crying in your beer and wondering how the heck am I ever going to have enough to retire to having 2 months that felt like it totally changed your financial future. Turned out there were still some bad times ahead for you, but it was a wild time. There are people who actually believe that the markets today have a lot of similarities to the markets then. Now, one of the reasons I'm sure that it was more volatile back then is because the market was not as liquid. We only had about 10% of the public involved in the market. In fact, it may have been even less than 10% by the time you got into the 30s, because in 1929 was, I think at that point, about 10% of investors were in the market. And then, of course, you got into some very difficult years. I might add to that, a good piece of history is that in 1925, a Dr. Smith wrote a book that made the point for the very first time to the public that stocks made more than bonds, and it showed history, a long history going back to the 1860s, on how much more profitable the stock market was than the bond market. And the public got all excited, and then guess what happened? Several years later, they ran right into 1929 and beyond. So there are things about that period that really make it meaningful in what the possibilities are in the period we're in right now or have been going through. You know, people often criticize me for looking at what happened back in the 30s. But the fact is that after inflation, the return for the 10 years, 29 to 38, the returns were actually much better than the returns from, 69 through 78. Or certainly 2000 through 2009. And that becomes very obvious when you start inflation adjusting the returns, which at the end of the day is what really matters. Remember when we do those tables, those distribution tables for people who are retiring with enough and don't have extra saved to kind of protect them from a rainy day, that we have to adjust the return every year or the distribution for whatever inflation might be. Inflation is a game changer in terms of having enough money. It's just not the return. Basically, it's the return after inflation and the return after taxes. And one of the things we've learned is that with massive diversification, there are going to be periods that we will actually bury. I mean, we will have returns 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 times more than the S&P 500 and a bond fund. And then there'll be other periods the S&P 500 will do better. In fact, that period from 95 to 99, that period that the S&P 500 was compounding at actually over 28%, 95 to 99, the worldwide strategy compounded at 11. How smart do you think I felt? And just as I want to focus on the things that we know and to do and help motivate you to actually take advantage of those things for your portfolio, remembering that my advocacy for whatever that particular combination of asset classes or in equities or combination of fixed income and equity or, you know, corporate bonds versus government bonds and all of these different decisions that we know that you're having to face because the choices are there. We are again looking backwards in the hopes of making sure that you make the best decisions. And the same is true with the rest of our financial lives. My wife and I, I'm 76. She's younger, but not all that much younger. But we're both in our 70s. And we take the coronavirus seriously. We know that it represents a lot of risk. As far as I'm concerned, a heck of a lot more risk than a bear market represents. And so with all of the health challenges that I've had, we're being real serious in discussing how do we keep ourselves safe during this period. We went to a restaurant. We took a drive to a restaurant at Port Gamble, not too far from Bainbridge Island. There's a bakery there that makes knockout sandwiches, and we wanted to take some sandwiches and our three dogs and go sit by the water. And my wife walked into the place, and nobody in the kitchen was wearing masks. Now, I'm not smart enough to know what that level of risk is specifically, but I sense that that is more risky than if they have those masks on. And so she just turned around and walked out and made that decision to manage the risk that we're concerned with. As I say, more than we are concerned with the bear market. But I got to tell you, we've had a lot of discussions about the implications, not only of the virus, but the implications of what it might do to the stock market in the U.S. for small companies as well as large, and international companies as well as for U.S. and how credible are we as a nation, and the guarantee that we make with our bonds? Should we have all of our bond holdings in U.S. government guaranteed or tax exempt municipalities? All those things are important, and we've tied them in to our discussions of our lifestyle. What are we willing to give up in order to make sure that the money we've saved lasts as long as we need it to last, and also creates a legacy for others? Or should we not give up the things we want to do and give up the legacy? Those are all possibilities, the same decisions as to how much we put in stocks and how much we put in bonds. We have a very nice home overlooking Puget Sound. It's beautiful. Someday when I'm doing a Zoom, I'll turn the camera around and you can look at what I see. It's a grand place to live, particularly when there's a beautiful sunset. But should we continue to own a house that's much bigger than we need, that costs more than we need, or should we be selling that house and downsizing to something that doesn't have the same view, and maybe is back in the woods? A change that we could certainly live with, but no, we're deciding to continue to take the risk that we're taking right now, just as we are deciding to continue to take the risk of how much we have in stocks and bonds. So these kinds of conversations, see, this is the beauty of having a financial planner, somebody to lead you through this process. So we're going through all of this stuff, how much we take out each year? Should we be cutting back the amount we're taking out? We take out 5% at the beginning of each year for us to be able to have whatever fun and give away whatever we want to give away for that particular calendar year. Should we be cutting that back to 4 and giving away less? Would that be the prudent thing to do? Should we be taking our money out monthly rather than annually? Because when you take it out annually at the first of the year, the implications are you're going to take out less money, leaving more in there to grow over the months that you're not taking it out. And over the rest of our life, we'll probably have more money to leave to others. Why are we so selfish in taking it out right at the first of the year? Because taking that money out for day-to-day needs in a market that's going up and down, and maybe we're just seeing the beginning of this up and down stuff, and maybe it will be up and down more like it was back in the 30s. We don't know. So all of these decisions require good conversations. I am blessed to have a wife who feels very differently about spending money than I do, which means that she presents a different view of what should be done with money. I, on the other hand, am good for her because I'm working to to protect the money. And I think we want to make sure that we're both happy in this process. And sometimes, yes, it does help to have somebody to kind of lead that discussion. By the way, she has an MBA from Berkeley, so she knows a lot about money. And we got to be careful as an investment advisor. Yes, I found a lot of times where in a couple, one person knew a whale of a lot more than the other about money. But I can tell you, the other person oftentimes knew a whale of a lot more about living than the person who knew so much about money. And just because one person's not an expert on investing doesn't mean one, they are emotionally tied into the success of those investments, and two, may know more about other aspects of our life they should be listened to. And I will tell you that when I was talking to couples about these kinds of things, it was sometimes a challenge to get that person who was not an expert in investing to be involved in the rest of the conversation. And that is one reason that when I first went into the business in 1983, and I would have a conversation with a couple that might be considering using our help, that it didn't take very long. In an hour, I could learn most everything I needed to about their investments. But I can tell you there's a reason why today when you open an account with any legitimate investment advisor, there is more like a 6-hour period series of meetings kind of getting to know you and really understand you to be able to give real investment and life coaching advice. Because in many ways, the work of a good advisor is more about life coaching than it is about being a financial investment expert. Because remember, nobody knows the future. And these people who are telling you what to do with your money, all they know about is what it did in the past. They don't have any more knowledge about what it will do than you do, except what's happened in the past. And we all know, because we've been told a million times, the future doesn't necessarily or won't look like the past. So here's what you can do to help me. You know I am committed, and Chris Pedersen and Daryl Balls, in fact, the whole team that work on this project. The whole team is dedicated to trying to help people do better. In fact, Aisha on her own has nothing to do with the Merriman Foundation per se, has been spending time developing a website trying to be there to help women who are challenged with financial decisions. She's committed. And where you can help us and give us information that is valuable. It's valuable for Chris and Daryl and myself in terms of what we teach or how we teach or share our information. I know that Daryl, just with his new tables that we'll be showing, particularly I know we'll be showing at the AAII presentation Saturday morning, he has found a much better way to make that presentation. I still want to give an investor the whole table, but he's found a nice way to condense the information and make it easy for you to compare one strategy with another. But as you go through our work, whether it's the fine-tuning work, whether it's the distributions work, whether it's the contribution work that we're doing, if you don't get those tables, then we're failing you, because those tables, I think, when I say they're worth $1 million, I say that because I think the stories are clear enough that we can see what steps we should likely take, not knowing what we'll get, but likely take in order to do better with our investments, to do better in terms of what we can end up giving to others, to do better on the lifestyle we're able to pay for, and the ability to sleep well at night. All of those things are obviously important. So what you can do, and I know I don't get around to answering all the emails, and I'm behind on the Q&As, I know, and I'm sorry, but when you send in a question, and it's about these really big decisions, like the decision regarding the equity asset classes that we recommend, or the decision how much in each equity asset class, or how much in fixed income, or the decision to use government bonds instead of high-yield bonds, because the high-yield bonds obviously pay more. Or maybe it's about the distributions, because I can imagine when we show you tables that show 3, 4, 5, and 6% distributions fixed, and 3, 4, 5, and 6% distributions flexible, and then we show you beginning of the year distributions and end of the year distributions, that those things can get confusing. So in your subject line, I am confused, and then put one word after it. Equities, distributions, 4-fund, 10-fund, flexible. Give me an idea where you're going, because sometimes I open up your emails and they are, for me, a slow reader that I am, it's a 15-minute to 30-minute job to get through and understand the long discussion. So if you kind of tell me where you're going in that subject line, it sure makes it easier on me, and I'm sure that Daryl and Chris feel the same way. And I do want to make it very clear. Not everybody gets up at 4 in the morning and works on this stuff. Chris and Daryl put a lot of hours in. They do not get paid a penny for working for this foundation. It's all out and nothing in. And by the way, when they get thank yous from you folks, it's a really big deal to them. It is to me too. But some of us, just because of the nature of whatever it is we like about doing this, put in more hours, but I'm still trying to figure out how to get more done in less time so I can get to more people. So that subject line helps a lot. And before I close, I want to share an email with you. A young fellow, 21 years old, he's an engineering student, and he says, I've been interested in finance for about a year now. I've started to learn some of the math behind CAPM and would like to tinker with efficient frontier calculations. Is the data for returns of asset classes that you've used for the different portfolios you've discussed in recent weeks available to the public? If not, who could I ask to get it? I'm looking for monthly returns, the prices of indexes to make these calculations. And so I wrote back to this young fellow, and I told him that he could get some of that information from Portfolio Visualizer. That's where Chris gets a lot of his numbers. On the other hand, Daryl uses a database that goes back to the 20s. It's not available to the general public. And I finished the email I sent to him. And I said, I hope you don't spend too much of your life figuring out how to beat the market. And if he's understanding investing at age 21, he can learn enough to start himself on the way and just keep going without having to have it consume his life. And he came back and he said, right now, I am fascinated with learning about how markets work and wanted to implement it. I did and found out that your advice and my plans to be a conscious spender, I shouldn't have to worry about beating the market. Since I plan to live below my means and I'm starting young, I needn't waste time trying to beat the market, since I'm sure if I did, I would spend way more time than it's worth. Thank you for the work you do, particularly reminding listeners how impactful a monetary gift to a newborn child can mean. That's what I plan to do for future children that gets added to my family down the road. I hope you know your work will have rippling effects for generations, helping more than just the listeners, but their growing families as well. I wrote back to him, and at the end of my note, I said, I think the rippling impact of your knowledge will be much larger than you're thinking today. I predict you will help a lot of people make better investment decisions. The group will include fellow engineers, your children's grandparents, as well as friends who will ask you how you have done so well. I also predict you will someday be on the committee that oversees the selection of investments for your company's 401k plan. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. Even your thoughts as a 21-year-old are about to change some lives. I guarantee it. Thanks for joining me today, and I hope that I will see some of you either with the old people in the morning or the young people in the afternoon in San Diego this coming Saturday. Take care and good luck.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.